Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm your host, Jason Verlinde. As always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. This is our 400th episode, folks. I cannot believe it. We've been at this podcast thing for a long time. Obviously, we now produce a whole bunch of other shows, including Luthier on Luthier and The Truth About Vintage Amps. But for 400 episodes, I don't know what I've done 400 times in my life. We have been on this show every week, talking to some of our favorite people from the world of guitars. Could be luthiers, could be players, could be collectors, you name it. The only qualification is I have to truly like them as a human being and love what they do. And as I was starting to think about the 400th episode of this show and who should be on it, one interview stood out. It's an interview I've been sitting on for a few months now, and now is the perfect time to share it for a lot of reasons. Fred Wallachy is this larger-than-life person, an amazing human being who was the owner of Westwood Music. He inherited basically a violin shop. Fred was just like a teenager when he got it, and he transformed the shop into this important place for rock and roll history. It is where all the musicians, the early rock stars, the Laurel Canyon musicians came to buy their guitars from Fred. As the years went on, it became sort of just this hangout spot. I remember going there 15 years ago and hanging out on the brown leather couch with Colin Hay from Men at Work and a couple other great musicians who were just being there holding court. It was a truly magical place. And Fred is a pretty magical human being. And when he had throat cancer in the year 2000, the tribute concert that took place for Fred, which went on for two nights, was off the charts cool. Jackson Browne, David Crosby, Don Henley, Spinal Tap, all of these incredible musicians showed up to support Fred. Fred is thankfully still with us. He is now semi-retired, working on instruments at his own pace, doing repairs at a little shop that he has in Malibu, California. So that's Fred's story. Now I got to jump to Isaac Jang. Isaac is a force of nature, the most energetic person I know, and makes some of the most exquisite acoustic guitars imaginable. He is also down in California. Isaac was the temporary custodian of Linda Manzer's Sunflower Guitar for Ukraine project. This is a guitar that we've had on the podcast before. We've written about it in the past. It was at our Fretboard Summit last August. This is a guitar that is being passed around from great musician to great musician. Everyone is signing the case. It is a beautiful way to support the people of Ukraine. And Isaac had this guitar, and he had just taken it to Joni Mitchell. And I was able to connect Isaac with David Crosby. And a few months ago, Isaac was able to drive this guitar to Santa Ynez, California, have David play it, have David sign the case. And it was a beautiful thing, made even more poignant because David, of course, is sadly no longer with us. So Isaac told me about this trip that he was going to take with this guitar for approximately 2 hours from his house to David Crosby's house. And he told me that Fred was going to join him for the ride. Being the intrepid podcaster journalist that I am, I said, man, wouldn't it be great to be a fly on the wall for that car ride? And that, folks, is what you all get to do for the 400th episode of the Fretboard Journal podcast. Isaac recorded the conversation with Fred. Fred went deep on Joni Mitchell, who he affectionately calls Beethoven in drag, and went through the entire history of his relationship with Joni and how he turned her on to the guitars of Ken Parker and so much more. Fred is regaling us with stories, largely about Joni, for an hour and a half, and it is truly an unforgettable little journey that we all get to go on. Now, this is a car ride. There was wind noise. I had to do a lot of noise reduction. It is not the easiest conversation to hear at first, but if you stick with it, you are going to hear some incredible stories that you're not going to hear anywhere else, and you're going to understand why Fred is one of my favorite people in the world of musical instruments. I can't thank Isaac enough for doing this. Maybe we'll do more of these. I don't know. Again, thank you all for tuning in to the Fretboard Journal podcast. If you want to support the show, of course, get a subscription to the Fretboard Journal magazine. It goes a long way towards powering this podcast and all the fun stuff that we do. I also want to give a shout out to our sponsors, Peghead Nation. You can get your first month free or $20 off any annual subscription with the promo code FRETBOARD. one of the great music instruction portals around. Deering Banjos is now sponsoring the podcast, a great American-made banjo company. I love their Ten Brooks line. If anybody out there has listened to Noam Pikilny or Bela Fleck and thought about taking up the banjo, this is your year to do it. Check out Deering's site. They have pretty much everything imaginable at every price point, from starter banjo all the way up to the most deluxe, over-the-top, ornate banjo you can imagine. We're also brought to you by Stringjoy Strings, one of the coolest string companies around. They're based in Nashville, Tennessee. You can do custom sets. You can do custom gauges. You can do bulk orders. Whatever quirky thing you have going on in the world of acoustic or electric strings, Stringjoy has you covered. Go to stringjoy.com. They also just bought Gun Street Wiring, one of the great preloaded pickup wiring companies around. Check them out. Last but not least, we're brought to you by our friends over in New York at Retrofret Vintage Guitars. I told you last week about Ry Cooter's F7 mandolin at Retrofret. It's already on hold. It's already been sold, but they've got so much more in stock. And they're getting stuff every day, it seems, including a 61 Martin D18. They just got a 2013 Collings MF mandolin and a lot more. Check out all their offerings at retrofret.com. Those are our sponsors. Again, thank you to everybody who has joined us here on the Fretboard Journal podcast. If you truly love the show, share it with your friends on social media or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Both things go a long way towards helping this show grow. Check out all the other podcasts we have going on. If you go to fretboardjournal.com, just click on the podcast tab. You'll see everything we've ever put out. It's a wide array of content. And again, I hope you enjoy this little journey we're all about to take with Fred Wallachy of Westwood Music and Isaac Jang. Fred's telling us all about his time with Joni Mitchell. There are some stories here that are just truly, truly incredible. I hope you enjoy it. Here is to the next 400 episodes again. Thanks for tuning in. It means the world to me.
Hello, my name is Isaac Jang. I'm a guitar maker in Los Angeles. I'm here with my good friend Fred Wallachy of Westwood Music on our way to go see David Crosby as part of the Sunflower Guitar Project for Ukraine by Linda Mentor. Jason wanted his audience to know what Fred has been up to, so here's my conversation with Fred. Hi Fred, it's good to have you today. How are you and what have you been up to?
Well, you know, it is difficult to go into the final years where I, you know, tried to breathe in and out of Westwood Music and you know, everything changed so radically when the store was bought. Like, for instance, we never used to use a computer. We had a little machine, and we would write up our sales receipts and our repair receipts on. And we would turn a handle, and copies would come out. One copy would stay in the machine, two would come out, give one to the customer. A guy would walk in and say, I want to buy a set of strings. We'd say, yeah, man, what strings do you like? Here they are, put them on the counter. Okay, for $9.95 in tax, we go to the cash register where we could do $9 and two more buttons to go $95. So now we press three buttons down. You don't even have to write anything up. We take the money, the cash register door opens up, we get his money, and we say, so, have you played a good guitar lately? Why now? Well, come on over. I got one here that is the reason you go to work, I'm sure. And we sit down, we play guitar.
Right.
And, turned into this other deal where a guy's getting a set of strings. What's your name? What's your email? What's your address? What's your phone number? I got done. He's got his guitar strings. He's getting me out of here. And he goes out and gets a $32 ticket. Or $64. Yeah, I forgot how much they were doing. So anyways, okay. So I move from the top of the Santa Monica Mountains down to this. A place on the beach. There's a, like a beach place that Kathy and I can maintain. And this is like 10 years ago now. And I have got all of my stuff in storage from Western Music. I wish I had more of my repair tools, but I sold them at the store. But anyway, I think, okay, well, I've got to figure out how to find a place to continue to do work, hang out with my friends, and mildly support myself. Now, when I say that, it's not that I don't need it. Much of money to support myself. I'm just dealing with being a laryngectomy. And, you know, you can't show a guitar and talk about it and play it at the same time when you're pressing on your neck. So things change radically. So I, through family friends, find this, or get offered, I knew it was there, a beautiful little art joint in the back of a cactus nursery. And, we work out a deal. And at that time, I think you called me to tell me that John was going to kill himself if I didn't help him. That he was a hopeless alcoholic. And when I talked to him, I think it was you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was John Peterson of World of Strings.
Right.
The store was closed down. And
And you were going to help him save his life. Just because his business partner had actually committed suicide.
Oh, how do you know that?
Oh, yeah. His business partner was a good guitar maker, acoustic guitar maker of World of Strings.
Oh, well, that's a... Bob Mattingly?
Exactly.
Oh.
And he committed suicide out on the break wall.
Oh, man.
So anyway, you told me to call him. I said, listen, give me the address of World of Strings if he's there. So I immediately jumped in the truck. I knew I had this place nailed down, this new location. So I get down there and I see him out by the trash bin and he's having a hard time standing up. So I walk into his viewplane. He's looking at the ground and he sees my feet and he follows the feet up to my face. And I said, hi, John, I'm Fred Wallachy. And you could see the brain kind of working. He goes, oh. And I said, you know, John, I don't think anybody knows what it's like to close down a store that you've run for over half your life, except for maybe me. Can I take you to lunch? He says, yeah. So, you know, he's having a lot of trouble walking. We walk to this restaurant. And I offer him a place to work if he wants to work. I don't say anything about, but you have to be sober. Anyway, it was quite a while. And he would come up. He was great. He would come up every day and he would work on stuff. And people would, that were his customers for Culver Springs, would even rather go to Malibu than drive down to Long Beach. And so he was happy as a clam. He was still drinking anyway. Completely different story. God really wanted him to quit drinking, and he quit drinking. And nobody could believe he quit drinking. It was unbelievable. So anyway, so I had these great bass players come in, and I would have, you know, really my good musician friends come in, and we had our little joint, man. When we say joint, we didn't have a joint. We had a little shop.
It's amazing because every time I go visit you, there's always something really fun happening, right? I mean, one time I go, and all of a sudden Gary Busey shows up.
Oh, God, pariah. Yeah, I know. I shouldn't say that. He's different. Okay, so, but he's my friend, and so he got out. But no, we have a lot of really important, wonderful clients, you know. If they're not fantastic musicians, they're fantastic people, and you know, we have a lot of fun. And I have just enough work to pay the rent, and once in a while, it's some extra money. And so, that kind of was my life, you know, or is my life. And I have fabulous friends. And, you know, that's the way it's been.
That's beautiful. In my conversation with Joni last week, she mentioned about her involvement with the jazz chorus. Could you tell me more about it?
What happened was she came to me with a tape. And she said, you know, here's this tape, and there's Robbie Robertson's got an idea to do a documentary about the band. And he's got a number of artists. They're going to be on the documentary, and they got a great producer to do it, who is Scorsese. And so it could be a big deal. That was later to become The Last Waltz.
Wow.
And so Robbie had come to me with three guitars. And the idea was, you know, of the three guitars, I'd like to have this neck put on that body and this on this. And all three were spectacular Stratocasters. And when I started switching the necks, they went from incredible Stratocasters to very good Stratocasters. And the reason for this is he wanted to have one of them bronzed for The Last Waltz, which we did. Well, I had my hands full because our store was kind of like the hub for a lot of things that were going on. And I was good friends with a lot of the different road managers. So on this deal, a couple of the road managers, we all kind of worked together. Well, she comes in, you know, not necessarily close to the date, but close enough. So when she hands me this tape, I'm thinking to myself, what can I possibly do at this late date to have a designer, a sound designer, make the sound of the guitar that she played on a Hygera? And what she had done is she had recorded three guitars on three different tracks, all in the same tuning. And she played exactly the same thing, but she got this unusual sound. As explained to me, I never did ever listen to the tape. Because the next day I got a call. You know, she said, can you do it? I said, I'll try. I'll try. You know, and I had Jimi Hendrix's technician and engineer from the Rainbow Bridge album that I could access. Great guy with electronics. Blah, blah, blah. But could he possibly do it? He was already doing a 96-pin connector for a big board we were doing. Anyway, so what happens is, the next day I get a call from this guy, Tom Beckman. And he says, hi, my name's Tom Beckman. And I just bought Camco drums. And I'm selling drum hardware. And you have Westwood Drum Shop. Well, I said, yeah, are you talking about new old stock? You're talking about new hardware? He said, yeah. And I said, oh man, I bought Camco drums. You know, that FD Fencer that are injured just for the hardware. I'll meet you wherever you are. So I jump in the car and I go down to the city of industry to one of these industrial garages. And he, you know, is standing there in the doorway. And I buy a bunch of hardware and he says, hey, listen, you know, I'm working with this guy in Japan who is a fantastic designer of electronics. Is there anything that you need in your industry? And I told him what happened yesterday with Jody Mitchell. And he said, okay, I'll follow you over to the store and get the tape. So I give him the tape and he pouches it out immediately to Tokyo. And it goes to Mr. Takahashi, who is a young guy who drives into Tokyo at 4:30 in the morning to get a parking place. And then goes to work and then goes home when he's supposed to, you know. Hey, by the way, check this out. See that flame?
Yes, what's that?
See that flame? That could be powering a steam engine that generates electricity. But they just let it go off into the air. They all do that.
Oh, so it's wasted energy.
Yeah, it's wasted. But the technology. See, that's what I thought when Biden said that he was going to stop oil and gas from being necessary. I didn't realize he meant that he didn't mean necessary. He meant he was dedicated to stop it.
Oh.
And I was thinking he was going to take advantage of like thermal generation. Yes, we have hot springs, you know. That can generate thermal energy. See the steam coming out of it?
Yes. Oh, they could all be used for...
That could all be converted.
But now they're all just going back up in the air, wasted.
Being wasted before it goes on. Meanwhile, we have a water shortage. So how do we get our electricity? Part of it, a big part of it, is through hydroelectric. And how do you get hydroelectric? Well, you spill the water over a dam.
Mm-hmm.
And then run it into the ocean. So anyway, so sorry about that side detour. Okay, so I don't even think about it. I'm on to other things.
Yeah.
Getting the guitar bronzed, the other stuff that has to go up to the last waltz. Running the music store, because we were doing a lot of business. We used to look at our daily total, and if we didn't do $6,000, we would go, man, why did we even bother coming to work? Because, you know, we had like four repairmen.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, it was, you know, it was a whole different operation than what Jay would have used to. Anyway, so, like, we sold gaffer's tape, Swiss Army knives, Cal lights. We sold all the disposables to go on tour.
Oh, so you did the whole studio setup.
Oh, yeah, I had a Victorinox Swiss Army knife franchise, you know.
Wow.
We would get boxes of Rocola cough drops for the Beach Boys. Everything for the Beach Boys. Everything for Jackson Browne. Everything for Joni. You know, all the bands. The reason why, besides the social involvement, was because I had contacted all the accountants and said, look, if you're reliable, I'll let your road crew sign for things they buy. They don't have to come to you for a check every day. And they won't need petty cash.
Right.
You can charge. And, you know, so I had guys showing up going, God, I don't know. I don't know this man. How did you even find us? Oh, well, we found out through this accountant that we should come and buy stuff from here. And I was like, really? I've never dealt with war in my life. But here comes war out of nowhere, you know, in a lot of these kind of bands. So, anyway, and all is going on. All of a sudden, I get there. There's this truck that pulls up. You're going to have to need to get over there soon. A truck pulls up from Nippongaki. And the idea is that there's a crate. And I go, what is this? And I see that it's from Beckman.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, wow, Beckman. Well, Beckman and Mr. Takahashi put together a company. Mr. Takahashi had an English friend by the name of Roland.
Oh.
And he knew how to spell Roland. And that became the name of the company, Roland.
What?
Yeah, it was very cool. So anyway, they had already had some products known as Roland. But anyway, Beckman was selling, but I wasn't aware of any of them. Anyway, what happened was, the thing goes up there, and I get a call from Joni saying, would you send me another one? And she asked me for a box, because up until that time, we had seen things like compressors, you know, but we had never seen a jazz chorus or a chorus pedal.
Yeah.
There wasn't any. And here comes this amp that's later called the jazz chorus. And she wants another one. I said, Joan, there's only one. That's yours. That's it. She goes, well, Jocko's plugged into it. And he says, that's his sound. And I said, well, come on, you're the hero. You tell Jocko to unplug. She goes, you tell Jocko to unplug. And all of a sudden, there's Jocko. And I had done some work for him to make his number two bass sound like his number one bass. One of the things about his sound was he had a high spot on the end of his fingerboard on his fretless.
Oh.
And it was getting another little sound in there.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted that sound on his number two bass.
Oh.
When he first showed it to me, I didn't know it from Adam. He had just come from Florida. And he heard I worked on cellos. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, I play frontless bass. Can you number two bass to sound like my number one bass? So I'm listening to this bass and I go, oh yeah, man, I know what the problem is. I can get rid of it. He goes, no. That's, that's my number one bass. I said, oh, what's the high spot at the end of the fingerboard? I can do that. Come back in a couple hours. I'll do that. And even though, you know, we were doing, I was not doing repairs per se. This is exactly my wheelhouse. So he comes back, and it was so funny because he swore like nobody I've ever talked to before. Every other word was fuck. And I didn't get it right away. He said, he starts playing, and I'm listening to him, and I'm going, oh, my God. This is like what Charlie Parker did to the saxophone. Uh-huh. He totally changed the way the saxophone was used. Uh-huh. And I said, hey, man, you got to be the greatest bass player in the world. Uh-huh. And he goes, yeah, man, I'm the baddest motherfucker there is. And I said, no, I'm serious. I'm totally serious. She said, oh, I know. The rest of these guys can't even come close. And I said, no, look at that. I'm not being effusive. I'm really serious. And then I realized he wasn't doing a Buddy Rich imitation. Buddy Rich used to talk about how great he was. Uh-huh. In exactly that same way. But he wasn't kidding. Well, so he's playing these cello concertos on bass. And my mom is doing bookkeeping upstairs. Uh-huh. And she hears this and she comes down. And the minute she shows up, he turns into Eddie Sasshole from Leave It to Beaver, where he doesn't swear at all. And hello, this is Wallach, you know. Okay. So anyway, we started to get to be friends. So anyway, this is after that period of time with his basses that he's up there. And I get my best adult voice on the phone and I say, Jaco, you unplug from that amplifier this very minute. He says, no, man, this is my sound. I've been waiting for this sound my whole life. I said, yeah, but she's the hero. She's there to push this album. Come on, man, you know. I will make certain that we incorporate this somehow in your sound. So I called Aspen Pittman, who was then the president of Acoustic Amplifiers.
Okay.
And Jaco was an acoustic amplifier in Dorsey. So anyway, we worked together with Roland and we put a chorus circuit board inside an acoustic amp for Jaco. That was, you know, later after the show, you know, after the last waltz, of course. Anyway, so getting back to what we were talking about, which is, I forgot, but anyway, the VGA, and then we went on. So now, go years and years and years forward, I'm talking to Chris Bristol. Now, Chris Bristol and Mark Cohen are the two best musical instrument salesmen in the world, as far as I'm concerned. Mark Cohen started the company Fostex here in the United States. And Mark Cohen was kind enough to give me the exclusive dealership for Los Angeles, Greater Los Angeles, for 1 year. If I would show Fostex to our clients. And we put them in everybody's backyard, you know. Anyway, the other guy who's the greatest salesman was Chris Bristol. you weren't, and we were both, when my dad died, I was 19. And I had to take over the music store. And I had reasons to call Maurice Stein, which he had a music store we called Stein on Blind. And Maurice Stein had a kid working my age for him by the name of Chris Bristol, who was a good guitar player, but without a question, the most personable guy and the best salesman. So we got to be really good friends and we sent each other business. Well, wouldn't you know, Chris Bristol starts to work for this new company, Roland, and years later becomes the vice president.
Whoa.
So I tell Chris, who's my close friend, you know what? We've got a problem here. Joni Mitchell, in order to go on the road, we have to take 9 guitars.
Uh-huh.
And she has this brilliant guitar tech and brilliant human. Who's a phenomenal photographer and writer by the name of Joel Bernstein. And Joel Bernstein is tearing his hair out because they'll have a set list figured out for a concert. And she vibes the crowd and starts changing the set list. Well, she has 52 songs.
Whoa.
And she could play at any time. And there are 9 guitars that come close to some of the other songs that are not on the set list. So, in other words, he can reach for number 7 and know that he only has to turn that G string down to a D. And then that's her tuning for that new song that she just decided to sing out of nowhere.
Wow.
I said, what we could use is a guitar that could change tunings automatically. And I said, there's these guys in Colorado that Graham Nash just financed. And they have this invention. Graham Nash was always cutting edge on new stuff. He still is, I'm sure. And he's angelic. He helps people. He could be an angel. We're not sure. He's under suspicion of being an angel. And, really, really, he is. He's unbelievable. So he had financed these guys to work on this mechanism that would change tuning. But what it was to do is just basically to go to a D tuning and otherwise put your guitar in tune when it was out of tune. Nothing like what Chris Bristol called me about. And it was before the New Orleans Jazz Festival. And he said, Fred, we have a machine that'll go into the 52 tunings. And I said, you do? He said, yeah. He said, it doesn't right now because we need you and her guitar tech to dial in the tunings, but it will. It will do a 12 string. And it will, you know, so you have 12 different strings that each one has a, you know, it's tuned to a certain note. Mr. Takahashi says that we can change any one of those 12 strings.
Wow.
Do whatever we want. And if it's to imitate us, Joni's tunings, we use 6 of the 12 strings and go into one of her tunings. So I said, oh man, he said, I'll beat it over there and we can try this thing out together. I said, yeah, so here comes Chris Bristol and the machine. And we're down on our hands and knees and cross-legged, and we're fooling around with this box until God knows what time of the night. and I'm going into these tunings. Now, the way Jody does her tunings is she invents them.
Wow.
And she doesn't start necessarily with six strings on the guitar trying another tuning. She'll start with a guitar with no strings.
Oh.
And she puts on the low E. And she starts it from flabby up to some note that she likes the resonance.
Wow.
And she goes, okay, let's leave that there. And she puts on the next string. And now she gets the two strings to like each other.
What?
And now she puts on the third string. And she inevitably comes up with a open chord that seems in all cases to be a sus chord.
Oh.
And they're all different. And then she works out the figurings for some poetry she's written. And she writes the melody to this tuning and her poetry. And of course, you know, it's totally jazzy because she's a jazzer. Anyway, so I'm not going to tell her about this machine. Because the New Orleans Jazz Festival is about to happen. And we don't want to spring new technology on her. Or on Joel Bernstein. Because Joel Bernstein is an acoustic guitar guy. When he was a little kid, he showed up at the Troubadour. And he walks up to her and says, Miss Mitchell, I know all your guitar tunings, and my name is Joel Bernstein, and I want to work for you. And she looks down at Joel and says, well, Joel, you know all my guitar tunings. He says, yes, I do. I know all your guitar tunings, and I want to work for you. I can be your technician.
Wow.
And she said, well, let's give it a try. So she meets with him and he goes into all the tunings. And she says, okay, you got a job. He says, well, there's one problem. If I won't work for you and go out and do these concerts, my mother has to drive me because I'm not old enough to get a driver's license. So anyway, you know, when they go on tour, obviously he sees her on the bus or the airplane. Anyway, he had been with her for years and years and years, but I wasn't about to say to Joel, you know, 2 weeks from now, you're going to have a whole new system. So I don't tell her. Well, she tells me, she says, by the way, after this, I'm closing the New Orleans Jazz Festival, and I'm going to announce I'm quitting. I'm doing a lot of painting. I don't need this. And I said, what do you mean you don't need this? She goes, I'm never in tune. And these sound guys never get my sound right. And I said, well, look, you've been doing nothing but one-offs since 1982. And with regards to guitars are never in tune, I can tell you, when Joel gives you that guitar, it's totally in tune. But you have such perfect ears that if the monitor mixer has what all guitar pickups have, which is an alias tone that is below the low note of the guitar. You get a subharmonic on all guitar pickups.
Oh.
It just happens. You can't get rid of it except using a lot of onboard electronics. And you also get harmonics above the high E. Because you're listening to your guitar, which is that guitar is your reference monitor? What is it, a perfect reference monitor? Because it is the...
It is the
reference.
Yeah.
Yeah, the guitar only has so much highs and so much lows. But the pickup is capable of picking up more highs and more lows. Not only that, but when you're doing a guitar and you're the sound mixer, you're sending the guitar sound through a tweeter. Mm-hmm. A tweeter tweets immediately. Mm-hmm. A woofer takes time to woof. So you'll never get the treble right. Because the top end is hitting you milliseconds ahead of the bottom end. So you'll never be satisfied, really satisfied, with the top end. Now, there were some companies like Myers that make monitors that were time-aligned. Yuri made monitors that were time-aligned. But you wouldn't find those on rock stages. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that the monitor mixer and the house mixer had to come up against. But if they're working with Jody for the first time and the only time, how good can it be? So she plays the David Letterman show. He has the studio cool to 47 degrees. You come out of the tuning room, which is 70 degrees, into 47 degrees, and yeah, it'll be out of tune, but we had figured that out and corrected for it. But there's still no correcting for that perfect ear of hers. When she hears a subharmonic, and so she's listening to her low E, which is 82 cycles, and she's hearing a little percentage of 41 cycles, and she interprets it as a tuning difference and tries to tune it out.
But that's just part of the physics.
That's part of the physics problem.
Whoa.
I mean, yeah, she's amazing. She is Beethoven in drag.
Wow.
That's who Jody Mitchell is. Beethoven in drag.
Beethoven.
And so we little, you know, people of Philadelphia, inferior small brains are working with this giant. And very, you know, we all just, you know, watch and wonder at her. And, you know, she has a certain language, so when you're mixing her sound, she'll say, it sounds weedy. Well, we know what weedy means. She means it has too much of the high-end mid-range. So we try to correct, you know, thank God that George Massenburg, and really, it was George Massenburg invented the parametric EQ. And the story goes, and that's no joke, I remember going into a Little Feet rehearsal, and George Massenburg had this group of pots and potentiometers and the wires. It was a wiring harness for this thing that he called the parametric equalizer. And I don't know if it's true, but George Massenburg, besides being the Engineer of the Year award twice, is a regular guy and a wild man. And you put him together with the guys of Little Feet, and as the story goes, he invented and figured out the wiring and all the electronics to be able to make a parametric equalizer when he got out of jail overnight in London for he and the band apparently got into some mischief. And, you know, that, which doesn't, I mean, if I don't know if the George story is true, but if it is true, I know exactly why, because he's a great guy. He loves to have fun. It just so happens he's a mega genius. I mean, there's nobody here. I asked him one time, I said, George, is there anything about electronic genius you don't understand? And he said, yes, there is. And I couldn't believe it. I said, what's that? He said, ground loops.
Ground loops.
And I said, well, isn't the definition of a ground loop the differential between two chassis grounds? And he just raises his eyebrows and he smiles. Picks up his coffee and walks into the other room. And he enjoys Massenburg. He's another guy that is under suspicion of being an angel. And of course, he engineers some and produced some of the best albums on the planet, you know. Anyway, so I don't know where I got into the weeds with all of this, but it's got to be this. Got to be a crazy historic document by this time. Anyway, so so Jody, I said to Jody, I said, okay, look, don't. I explained, you know, look, you've done the one-offs. You've never had an even break on this deal. Don't say you're going to quit. I know of a machine that'll put your things in tunings so that I need to have it. I said, no, Joan, because if I show you the machine now and you want to use it, Joel Bernstein's going to kill me. And every other road crew guy, we have an understanding. You don't spring anything on the road crew with a new piece of equipment unless you get green lighted by the road crew. Because you don't want to go into a rehearsal that's supposed to be rehearsing music and screwing around with a new piece of technology. Now, this was absolutely proven later on in history when guitar players were all using racks.
Oh, yeah.
Because they'd come in my store and I would show them a new Eventide so-and-so. And they would go, oh, my God, I need this Eventide product, you know, rack mount. And now the guitar tech is forced to be rewiring the rack to put in the Eventide.
Wow.
And it's like, oh no, Wallachy, you know, I didn't, you know, it wasn't me, man. He bought it. That's all I know. I didn't tell him to put it in his rack. But see, before racks, we could govern what would go to the rehearsal. So that it was well organized and you could rehearse. Well, this was breaking that agreement. And I explained it to her. I said, listen, you know, she goes, no, this is too big. And she said, the sound you've got is unbelievable. I never wanted to play guitar. I don't play guitar. I play a thing that looks like a guitar. This gives me incredible latitude. Now I've got an orchestra. I said, lady, you may have an orchestra, but your fans are going to hate it. And sure enough, the fans went nuts. There was one other time. If you remember when Bob Dylan, actually, I don't think you were born yet, but Bob Dylan went out on stage with a Telecaster.
Oh.
And everybody booed, and oh, you know. Jody had had one experience that I reminded her of, where she goes out in a man's business suit.
Oh.
With her beautiful blonde hair tucked up into her hat. Oh. And she was wearing a men's hat. If what what she looked like as a pool shark. She and Sean have the Lee Scholars Halloween party with a mustache, and she had changed she's in makeup, so she had changed her appearance, but she had a pencil thin mustache, and she looked like a pool wrestler for Halloween.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And so she thought it would be a kick to wear that outfit without the mustache and changing the, you know, the complexion. She thought it would be really fun to wear that outfit on stage. Well, immediately, you know, the audience started griping. So she pulled off her hat and let her blonde hair fall out, and everybody was happy. So I reminded her of that, and I said, this isn't even close to that. You're showing up with a totally different sound. We're going to have, we can't do it. So we got to do it. I said, we just can't do it. And so she talks me into it. So I bring the thing up to her house, and she is nocturnal. So she goes to sleep, you know, at 2 in the morning. She gets 8 hours sleep. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And sometimes she'll want 12 hours sleep, and she'll get up at noon. Well, I don't, because I have a music store to go to.
Yes.
So I'm saying to Kathy, sweetheart, you know, I'm working with Joni tonight, so I'll be home late. Try to get home before the sun comes up. No joke. And she's being very sweet. But she knows that we are in the midst of this thing. And we're trying to figure out all these possible programming the machine for these tunings. And I bring in Roman Tech. At one point in time, because he's going to have to back me up and go to New Orleans for the Jazz Festival. Because I'm not going to go because I can't take that time off. We've got this monstrously busy music store. I can't leave the guys. And, I mean, that would lose a lot of money. Plus, I actually don't want to be part of it. I mean, the coward that I am. So, anyway, before they take off, the night before, I tell the tech, all right, I've removed off of all the sounds. You now have a version with no chorus and no reverb. Now, I had talked to the house mixer for Little Feet, because Little Feet was coming on the show before Joni.
Little Feet?
They were going to be the next band before Joni. Or the band before Joni. And I had talked to the house mixer, and I said, I know that we missed your rehearsal while you were in L.A. I had arranged for a rehearsal out at the power plant. But unfortunately, Joan had overslept. And we never got to let him rehearse with her. So once again, she's going into a gig without a rehearsal. But he says, look, we're going to be doing, I know where we're going to be the day before. We're doing an in-store in New Orleans in a record store. So I'll get her a CD. And I'll listen to it. And I'll know exactly what to do with that sound. And I had sent him some kind of a communication as to what the sound was like. Well, the mixer gets mugged in the French Quarter the night before the gig. After they did the in-store, they go out to party in the French Quarter, and he gets mugged, put in the hospital. So now we're dealing with somebody who doesn't know anything about the South. But what had happened was the night before in the hotel, Joni had beguiled. She wanted to rehearse with the deck. And she listens to the sound and goes, there's no reverb or chorus. So he puts reverb and chorus on. Well, a big hall has reverb. And part of the sound of a chorus is also kind of reverbing.
Right.
So that's why I took it off. So that there would be definition to the sound.
Otherwise,
it would be too jumbled. So about 12 o'clock our time, I get a call from Joel Bernstein. He goes, Fred, the sound was terrible. It was total horrible deal. It was horrible. And, you know, and I said, Joel, I'm so sorry. I can't tell you, blah, 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 blah. I was horrible, man. It just ruined the whole deal. Oh, God. Oh, God. So now what? Now I'm going to wait for Johnny's call. Phone rings. Now about maybe 1 o'clock our time. She goes, Fred, it was fantastic. I got a call from Joel. He said it was terrible. She goes, oh, no, no, don't worry about that.
What?
Well, the main thing is it worked. It's my fault. I talked him into putting reverb and chorus on. Now I know why he took it off. But it works. That's the main thing. We don't care about this gig. It's okay.
Uh-huh.
So she then later said, hey, man, with this sound, I can take the invitation that I've had to join the Bob Dylan Van Morrison tour.
Whoa.
Because of this machine, man.
Uh-huh.
Well, I had made a guitar for her. The way I did it was really simple. I had my friend, Mark Brown, who was really in contact with a lot of really fun people like Tom Anderson. And so she's a polio survivor. And I needed to make a, and I did this right away when I heard about the machine. And I went to House of Hardwood and I got two pieces of spruce. The spruce trees are narrow, as you know.
Yeah.
And I had them put it on a joiner, and I joined it, and I glued it together. And I, long story on the body, but I'll just cut to the chase. I sent the body, actually Mark Brown, called Tom Anderson, and had the body cut out to look like a Stratocaster with no pickups.
Oh.
And I think I sent you a video, maybe not, I'll send you a video of that where she's on, not the David Letterman show, but the, who was the other nice guy that took over for Johnny Carson? Yes, a so-and-so garage.
Oh, Jay Leno.
Yeah. As she was went on Jay Leno's show, it looks beautiful. She's playing the guitar that we put together, which we called green, or she called Greenpeace. It was green. And because it eliminated all the problems, it created peace. Okay, so now we start looking for State Street, right? 6 miles. Okay, so.
I think I saw the guitar edge. Oh, it's in the aluminum fly case at Joni's house under the pool table.
You got it.
Oh.
Okay, so she played that for 11 months. During that time, she loved the guitar. And from day one, I said, oh, yeah, I'm glad you love it, but We can even have a lighter guitar. I've heard of this guy who makes very light guitars by the name of Kent Parker. And what I'll do is I know Larry Fishman. And Larry Fishman is a friend of Kent Parker's. And so there's a NAMM show coming up. And I will talk to Kent Parker. So I go up to Larry Fishman. I said, hey, I hear that you can get a hold of Kent Parker. He said, yeah, what do you want with him? I said, I want him to make a guitar for Joni Mitchell. And this big bear of a man comes out standing from next to Larry Fishman and gives me a giant bear hug. Big laugh, you know, at that time he was a big guy. Uh-huh. He's now gotten into yoga and rowing, and he's Mr. Skinny Bones, and looks fantastic, and he's going to live to be 200. But anyway, so I said, you know, I built this guitar out of spruce. And of course, he knows what I know. Spruce trees are narrow. And he thinks I don't want to join two pieces of spruce together. Because God knows how that's going to work on the wall. I mean, we're used to spruce guitar tops coming apart. Seam cracking open, you know, the glue. So he makes it out of cedar. Well, he's never made a guitar out of cedar before. And just like cedar kills moths, it is hard on some people. Yeah. Kent Parker being one of the people. So he makes the guitar, but he'll never make another one out of cedar. And I keep telling Jody, this guy's making you a guitar. Well, what does it look like? She keeps saying. Every time I tell her, don't fall in love with my guitar. There's a guitar coming in that makes mine look like nothing. This guy's the best guitar so far ahead of the guitar curve when it comes to electric guitars. It's not funny. What does it look like? And I keep telling her, it looks like the movie Brazil. Because you got to talk to Joni the same way she talks. She talks in abstract terms.
Oh.
It's weedy. What does it look like? It looks like the movie Brazil. So that's all I'm going to say. Have you seen the movie? Well, see the movie. Looks like the movie. And so it comes in, I call her. She drives right down. And I open up the case. I have it in that flight case. Uh-huh. And she crosses her arms. And when you're a salesman, which is what I am, I'm reading body language. It's microseconds. Going, this is not good. And there's pure silence for maybe 7 seconds. And she goes, it's beautiful. It's like, oh, I can breathe, all right? Breathe out. Okay, breathe out. Breathe, friend, breathe. Okay, so she loved it. And off we go, man, with that one. And she was able to take the tour. Anyway, you know, now she was good for promoting albums and everything, when she otherwise wouldn't have ever been able to do in the future. And she could concentrate on her paintings as a major, and perform music kind of in her mind's eye as a minor. Though she loved both, she could back up the album now by doing a in-person on television. So she pushed a lot of albums that way. But she went on the David Letterman show promoting this album called It's, oh yeah, you're right. It's and Mrs. See, you know, yeah.
I know you've connected Joni with Ken Parker. Could you tell me the story?
She was really sweet. Check this out. Ken's coming to LA. So I called Joni. I said, hey, you know, Ken Parker, guy that made your guitar, coming to LA. I say, we blow his mind. Let's take him to dinner and surprise him. She said, count me up. I said, okay, so I know a little Mexican restaurant on Pico that's killer. She goes, great, I love Mexican food, let's go. So I said, okay, so I'll pick him up. And I said, oh, I'm going to take him to the best Mexican restaurant I know, which is this little place called Talpa in Pico. And I'll tell him, we're going to pick up a friend on the way. So we're going up, Veteran and I, and he says, so who's the friend? I said, you know, the lady we built it, you built a guitar for. He says, Joni Mitchell. And I said, yeah, Joni Mitchell. He goes, well, where are we going to go? To Joni Mitchell's house. And I have dinner with Joni Mitchell. I said, well, we're going to go out to dinner. Yeah. And he says, this is a mind-blowing bubble of bottling. So we're driving up Veteran, and he goes, so Joni Mitchell lives in this neighborhood? And I said, yeah, he lives in this neighborhood, you know. Little does he know, we're about to get to Sunset and going to Bel Air with homes are quite a bit different. So we pull into the driveway, and she purposely redid the gates so that the house would not be known as being a big house. And after that, we come in through the back door into the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And Joni meets us at the back door, and we come into the kitchen, and we're having a great time. And they're talking, you know, and she's telling him how grateful she is for the guitar. And he's telling her how grateful he is that she likes to play it. And she goes, wait a minute, I got something for you. So, sure. So, we go on, she goes off, and she comes back with a roll, all wrapped up in beautiful wrapping paper with ribbons hanging on it, very beautifully wrapped. And she hands it to him. And he undoes the wrapping, and it's Joni's artwork for the Jaco Pastorius album.
What?
And he starts crying. And she sees how emotional he is, so now she starts crying.
Aww.
And I look at my watch and I go, okay, you two, we need to get to dinner. So we go out of the driveway, and then we realize that my car, I'm driving this Jeep Comanche, and the back seat is filled with stuff. Uh-huh. So we tell her, well, let's take your car. Uh-huh. She goes, yeah, but I haven't started that car. I've been driving the pickup truck because, you know, I just drive the pickup truck because I use it to pick up my frames and stuff for painting. Uh-huh. And the battery on the Mercedes is dead. So we jump in the pickup truck. And so I'm in the back seat of this Toyota. Uh-huh. You know, pickup truck, all scrunched up. Parker's sitting, obviously, in the passenger seat, and Joni's driving.
What?
And Joni is was at that time a perpetual smoker.
Uh-huh.
So she no longer smokes. And so we're getting on the on-ramp of the 405 freeway to then get off on the 10 But we get on the on-ramp in Wilshire, and Parker takes off his seatbelt and lets it fly. And it, you know, hits the side window. And I knew immediately that Joni's cigarette ash must have fallen in his lap.
Oh.
And I'm scrunched up and back, and I said, Kevin, what's going on? Uh-huh. He says, well, I just figured it out. I'm in this little piece of tin, and I'm going on a freeway that scares me to death in Los Angeles, because he's not from around here, right? Uh-huh. And the chances of us getting killed could be pretty good. And here I am, going to get killed with Joni Mitchell driving, and you scratched up in the back seat. It doesn't get better than this. You know, he's such a great guy, you know, and he's a brilliant guy. I mean, how would anybody orchestrate something like that for the fun of it, right?
Wow.
You know, he's that guy. He's that guy. What happens is we have a beautiful dinner. We have a lot of fun.
All Mexican food?
Yeah. We get her back to her house and we say goodnight. This Ken's really tired from traveling. He's dead on his feet. And as it were, he was here, you know, for the reason. Not to meet Joni, but for his own reasons. And he hears that she's playing this concert in Boston. Well, he's got these venues in Boston. They all know Ken Parker. So he never has problems getting in backstage.
Nice.
So he's backstage, and here comes Joni and her guy and gang walking down the hallway, and he goes, hi, Joni. And he says, Ken Parker. She goes, of course, Ken. And gives him a giant hug. And he goes, oh, Joni, I just want to thank you so much for every picture you've taken, for any publicity you've always taken with my guitar. She goes, Ken, only a bobble. Yeah, she's just so sweet, only a bobble. He goes, God, I love you. And she goes, I love you. And he says, you go out and kill him tonight.
Oh.
And she goes, so that's the last time you talked to Joe.
And Fred, you have to tell me about the recent Newport Folk Festival, your secret mission for Joni's surprise appearance.
Well, remember, to really do this justice, I should bring in some names and things into the story, because it really got tense towards the end. Joni, remember that 7 years ago, she was found unconscious in a coma. And everybody, the hospital didn't really have a lot of hope. When she came out of the coma, some people will call it a brain aneurysm, and I'm not a doctor, though I play one on television. No, just kidding. I've got a doctor, so I'm not sure if a brain aneurysm is the same as a stroke. But if not, they're very related. So I early on, when she got to the house, she was surrounded by nurses and lived in the beginning. You know, doctors, you name it. Always there. And when things had cooled down pretty much, I got in touch with the one of her closest friends in the world, a woman by the name of Leslie Morris. You know, Leslie is a legend in the record business as a executive. Anyway, you know, I said, I'd love to get together with Joni. And she said, oh, okay, we just had Neil Young and her manager at that time. Her manager, period. And was also Neil's manager. And then I started thinking, wow, you know, I know what it's like to be recovering because I, you know, when I had my laryngectomy, I was only in intensive care for 6.5 days. And I was only in the hospital with no food or water for 32 days. Joni, when she was in a coma, was no food or water either. Thick lines running into her heart. So now I got to ask myself something. Do you want to meet up with Joni Mitchell as she is now? For the most part, would she even want to see people? I didn't want to see people when I came home. So, during the time, Joni is very close to our kids and our family. We spent a couple of Christmas Eves together with nobody else other than Joni, the kids, and her daughter, Cloran. And Cloran's boy is Jack's age, and Marlon. And so we had a couple of nice Christmas Eves, you know, and it was really fun meeting Cloran because, you know, Joni didn't know Cloran existed. You know, what had happened was she had to give the baby away for adoption. And she was in very poor health. She was struggling. Oh, man. I mean, if she ever writes the book, you know, she had very little to eat. She was being robbed of vitamins for the baby, and it's the only place they could find the body could find the baby. The vitamins was in her teeth, and she's incredible, man. She's totally incredible what she's been through. Anyway, so. She's amazing. Anyway, so
daughter.
Oh yeah, so we would have fun. We were close. So I had only gone to see Joni once with one of the kids, and I was bummed out. And the clinical name for it is depression. It's hard for me as a laryngectomy to ignore that I'm in a laryngectomy and go through every day pressing on my neck and using my esophagus to talk because I don't have vocal cords. So I rattle my esophagus. I've learned how to use my esophagus like it's vocal cords. Anyway, mentally, I want to do the Fred show for people. And for my wife, I can't afford to go into depression because the kids don't understand why Dad's depressed. Dad doesn't even really able to put his finger on it. So I got to watch. You know, people think, yo, so-and-so's very careful. They're worried about getting COVID. I'm really worried about getting depressed. I have to keep my eyes focused on the best thing in the world, which, as far as I'm concerned, is Henry Drummond's book, The Greatest Thing in the World, about, which is a analysis of a part of the Bible that a lot of people are familiar with, because they go into like the hippie bookstore and they see a little plaque that tells you what love isn't. It's from Corinthians. And this book is about what love isn't, but it says in such a loving way that it's the perfect book for keeping your mind on the things to bring you up to a place where, like Jesus promises, if you go after him and his, yeah, the way he's telling us to live and think, then we'll have life in that more abundantly. So I have to guard myself. So I had only seen Jody once during that time. And then I get the call. Okay, Fred, we're going to need you to fire up the VG8. Joni wants to start playing guitar again. I said, okay, tell me. So I go up, and lo and behold, we have a VG8. I was keeping a backup, which I had sent to Redwood. I rally, I go, and up here's Jody, and oh, we have a fabulous reunion. And I go to fire up the VGA, and it doesn't work.
Just a quick note for the listeners. The Roland VG8 is a guitar effects modeling system.
And there's a backup. But you know what? We can't risk it. If they're planning to get to use this further down the line for this performance that's going to be a secret, and I get sworn to secrecy, there's people in Newport that work for the concert that don't know what's going on. Nobody can know. Zero. And once I get there, I understand why. Number one, it's like showing up with Elvis Presley. Actually, not while Elvis was alive, but if he showed up now. Because everybody had kind of thought Joni was never going to be seen again, you know. We go ahead and, you know, try some things. And, you know, remember, this is a person that had to learn to walk and talk. A very fine painter that was learning how to sketch. And this woman is like, nobody like her. And you know, I leave the first night thinking, oh man, we're down to one VG8. We need a backup quick.
You can't afford to fail on you.
We only have one. So I call John McPhee, FEE, Doobie Brothers. And I said, John, do you have a VGA we can borrow? And he said, oh no, okay, you know, those are 25 years old. They're all dead except for I've got a couple that are still working. But I'm using a different system entirely. And I said, oh, right. You're using the, hold on. Let's see, I'm having a senior moment. You're using the line 6. So he says, yeah. And I said, I didn't think a line 6 could do that. And he says, it can't, except when it's tied in to a thing called a helix. And I went, really? So I go to the designer of the helix's house. And I'll plug in names later when we start really doing a serious documentary, because this man was fantastic. I can actually get his name right now.
That's what Joni mentioned, the brain. That's what it refers to, what she's referring to.
No, this was something and we thought we would have to switch to. And this gets kind of complicated, but not really. What happens is, I call this guy and I say, you know what? We're dependent on the VGA. But going back to Joni, so I drive up here and I get 2 VGAs from John McPhee. And yet I'm going, you know what? He has 3 others that are broken. No way of knowing how they're broken, but I did have a problem with the VGAs before I left Western Music. And their repair department couldn't fix them. They were, you know, they didn't have parts anymore. They were so old. So anyway, that was like, what, 1988 or something? And now it's, you know, 2022. That's an old machine.
Yeah.
So now I'm confronted with what to do. Because even if I have a stack of them, I don't want anything to go wrong on stage. Because we are going to have a limited amount of time at this folk festival in Newport. And Joni's going to hopefully be able to do a bunch of numbers, but in reality, we couldn't. Because she couldn't sing. So they figured out songs that they could sing, but the band could do it in the right keyboard by the time we would change her tunings into that key. They had lost the original quality on CD. Because when you change the pitch that much, it changes the character of the tone harmonics and everything. So what happened was this. We had to find another machine. And so I go to the designer of the Helix for Mind 6. I Simons, the guy who was like the big designer for the Moog.
Oh, yeah.
And all these other things. I go to this gorgeous house. And I call him in the meantime. He says, well, give me your 2 minutes. And, you know, I'm a sound designer. So I'll get the right sound and create the 2 minutes. Give me 3 songs. So I give him the 3 songs he wanted to do and move for it. So I show up at Joni's with the Line 6 guitars and the Helix. Thank God so far for John McVie helping me with the extra VGAs. Now, this other beautiful angel, I'll get you his name and everything, who gives me the Helix. And this is a multi-millionaire that's helping out. And, Joni picks up the mindset and goes, I can't play it. I said, Joni, well, you gotta play it. Well, I can't. I won't. So I think, whoa, wait a minute. There's got to be a modern version of the VGA. It's too incredible for them to just put on a shelf. There's got to be a modern version. So I call my friend Dallas Hsu, who is the most well-known guitar tech on the planet. Spend it with that. We can call him while we're on the road. Find out. It's been with you two for, I don't know, 28 years. And I say, Dallas, we got a problem. 2 heads are better than 1. What would you do? Because he's really cutting edge on everything. And he said, I don't know, man. Let me call my friend in London. He'll have an idea. So the friend of mine goes, hey, there's a box that is a scaled-down version of the VGA made by Roland called a GP10. If we can get into the GP10 through a laptop computer, we can make it do what you need to do for Joni. If it's not meant to do that at all. But it should be able to because it's the engine of the old VGA. So now Dallas gets all these long distance calls to England.
Yeah. And you're a person of love. You're sending love to many, many friends and family and all your clients who known you for decades. I mean,
everyone that talks about friends.
There's a lot of love in that shop, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we have a really good time. You know, I mean, we have friends like the quality of people like Chris Hillman, Bernie Lynn, you know, Bonnie Raitt, Linda Ronstadt, Chris, you know, that you love. From Spinal Tap.
Yes.
And all these other people, like, you know, they're my friends, you know. And we don't see each other a lot. You know, we talk from time to time. And, you know, Chris and I, it's really interesting. So there's enough work that it's almost hard to maintain friendships. But we do it little by little, you know, and everybody's busy.
All right. Was that a podcast or was that a podcast? Isaac Jang, Fred Wallachy, a car ride from LA to Santa Ynez, California for a worthy cause. I don't think you can ask for much more. Fred, it is so great to hear your voice. I'm so glad you're with us and still working on instruments. And the next time I'm in LA, I will come by and say hello. And to everybody out there who has tuned into this show, shared it with friends, emailed me feedback or anything else, thank you. 400 episodes. I guess in 2025, we'll be celebrating our 500th episode. Till then, stay tuned. We've got a lot more interviews coming.